Okay, we're in Job chapter 17, and it's been a long time since we were in Job 16, and so I had to really think about this whole section again. And without going into a whole bunch of detail on chapter 16, remember, this is Job's response now to Eliphaz. We're in the second cycle of dialogues, and Job's basically looking at the situation, and now he sees his friends, as we see in 16, they're sorry comforters. They've failed in their task to comfort Job. Job doesn't see any hope in this world at this point, right? Remember where he's at. He's sick physically. He's wasting away. He's dying. He's on the brink of death. He's depressed. He's got anxiety. Terrors are encompassing him. Satan is really unleashing everything against Job. And so Job's great hope is that he's going to die and God's going to take care of things, right? Chapter 16, really there shouldn't be a break between 16 and 17. Again, it's the artificial chapter break that's made there. And it's one of the bad ones. But you can imagine how long the chapter would be if you didn't have a break there. So I'm assuming that's why they did it. But 17 is just that. Job is continuing expressing this lack of hope in his situation. And the chapter just falls squarely into a genre category of lament. Job's lamenting, which again we said is a complaint. It's a form of biblical complaint. Let's read the chapter and then kind of jump into it. My spirit is broken. My days are extinguished. The grave is ready for me. Surely mockers are with me, and my eye gazes on their provocation. Lay down now a pledge for me with yourself. Who is there that will be my guarantor? For you have kept their heart from understanding, therefore you will not exalt them. He who informs against friends for a share of the spoil, the eyes of his children also will languish. But he who has made me a byword of the people, and I am one at whom men spit. My eye has also grown dim because of grief, and all my members are as a shadow. The upright will be appalled at this, and the innocent will stir up himself against the godless. Nevertheless, the righteous will hold to his way, and he who has clean hands will grow stronger and stronger. But come again, all of you now, for I do not find a wise man among you. My days are past, my plans are torn apart, even the wishes of my heart. They make night into day, saying the light is near in the presence of darkness. If I look for Sheol as my home, I make my bed in the darkness. If I call to the pit, you are my father, to the worm, my mother and my sister. Where now is my hope, and who regards my hope? Will it go down with me to Sheol? Shall we together go down into the dust? Now, you probably notice as I read that it doesn't flow really well in those latter verses. Those are really, really tough to translate. In fact, I'm scrambling here to pull up my Hebrew Bible. They're really tough to translate, and they pose a lot of difficulties because there's a whole bunch of sarcasm actually going on in here. And we'll kind of get that. But the chapter also doesn't divide up into really neat points like some of the other ones do. So the divisions I'm going to make are pretty artificial tonight. So keep that in mind as well. But what Job's doing is he's picturing now the reality that his only hope is death. Right? That's all he's got left. He sees his time in this world as coming to an end. And this is uh, this is the only thing that he can really grab a hold of, that at least his suffering is going to have an end. So thinking about this, I don't know if you've ever read Dante's Divine Comedy. If not, you should. It's actually a really good classical work. And in it, Dante is traveling through hell and purgatory and heaven. So you got to dismiss the purgatory part, right? You know, that's wrong. But just for the sake of the literature, it's a really good book. And as Dante is traveling into hell, there's this archway that enters into hell. And on the archway is this Latin phrase, Lassacati agne spernaza voi centrate. Which in English, it's a famous phrase, all hope abandon ye who enter here, right? You probably, if you've heard of that, that's from Dante in the Divine Comedy. This is what Job feels. Job feels like he's entered into that place, right? He's entered into a living hell, right? He's on the verge of abandoning all hope completely, even the hope in death. And he, like everyone who has endured great trials like this, he's going back and forth. And you see this in 16, right? There's some hope about a mediator. There's hope about someone that he can cry out to God there. And then in the very next chapter, which is just an artificial division, you know, he's back into despair, right? And this is what it's trying to convey to us, is the situation of the one who is suffering unjustly as they move back and forth from hope to despair. And it's just picturing the real human struggle of trials. Here in chapter 17, there's basically three points that I want to make. So we'll divide it up, verses 1 through 5. He's talking about the nearness of death, but that's not all he's going to talk about. Verses 6 through 10, In this chapter, his real desire is public vindication, and public vindication seems far away for Job. It seems like it'll never happen. And then verses 11 through 16, these are the results of hope fading away, is kind of how I would put it. Now, I could probably have like 15 points on this chapter, because every verse he's kind of saying something new and different. And it just was too much to try to sort that all out in an outline, but we'll point it out as we go through it. The first thing I want you to notice is that verses 1 through 2 are the continuation of 16, 18 through 22. Okay? Take away that chapter division, because he's in mid-sentence. So we'll read from 18. O earth, do not cover my blood. Let there be no resting place for my cry. So again, Job's saying, I'm suffering unjustly, and my blood's being poured out on the earth. And we talked about even Abel, we'll see this on Sunday, his blood cries out to God from the ground where Cain spilled it. This is what Job's saying. Let there be no resting place for my cry. Let the cry of unjust suffering continue. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven. My advocate is on high. Then he turns, my friends are my scoffers. My eye weeps to God, so he's turning only to God. God's his only hope. And then he says, oh, that a man might plead with God as a man with his neighbor, for when a few years are past, I shall go the way of no return. My spirit is broken, my days are extinguished, the grave is ready for me. Surely mockers are with me, and my eye gazes on their provocation. So you see how that all fits together. You try to break it up with the chapter division, you leave stuff behind. But we'll start there in 17:1. My spirit is broken. And I think this is an important thing, because in our English vernacular, when we say, my spirit's been broken, or their spirit's been broken, we mean something else, right? The Hebrew word here is ruha. And that word is not the idea of like, their self-determination's gone, or their will to live is extinguished. One commentator says, this is not his plucky will to live. I guess he must be from England. And that's that again, that's important. That's not what Job's saying. He's not saying, you know, I've lost all my will and I'm kind of feeling bad and blue today. But what ruah means in Hebrew, spirit, breath, or wind, it's his animating life force that's been given to him by God. The life that God breathed into man, that's the play on words of ruah. He's saying that the crushing of his spirit is sending him down into death. Okay? Not down into depression. Job's already depressed. Job's already feeling blue. He's utterly broken in that sense that we would say his spirit's broken. Now what he's saying here is that this is killing me. The oppression is killing me. He expects to die soon. This is why he follows it up. My days are extinguished. The grave is ready for me. Okay. Everything that's coming against Job is bringing about his actual physical death. And he's at a point where he feels that life that's inside of him slipping away. And if you spent much time with people who are in the process of physically dying, you see that actually happening as they get closer and closer to death. You know, this is not just a poetic expression here. They will tell you that as they're dying. You know, I've had people tell me, I'm coming up on the end. Like, I can feel myself slipping away. And that's where Job's at. The grave's ready for him. His days are extinguished. He feels his life slipping away. And this makes sense, right? Because Satan has been given permission to do everything but take his life. And so Satan has brought him to the edge. He's all the way to the edge. And he's killing him in his spirit through the oppression of other people. Now notice that in verse 2. Surely mockers are with me, and my eye gazes on their provocation. When it says with me, that is better translated as upon me or against me. Okay. Sometimes I don't know why the New American Standard translates the Old Testament the way it does. In fact, New American Standard is really not the best translation of the Old Testament. I think ESV actually does quite a bit better in places. But anyways, what Job's saying is people are mocking him for his misfortunes, right? His friends are even calling him a sinner who is suffering under God's wrath, even though God has constantly vindicated Job to us as the elevated reader who know the narrative. But much of his complaint, throughout all of his complaints and continuing, will be that he doesn't feel like he's ever going to get publicly vindicated, right? Everybody's saying, yeah, Job's suffering these things because of sin. And Job's saying, I'm innocent. And he's begging God, please vindicate me publicly. And so what he's saying is, surely mockers are against me. Surely they're upon me. They're not letting up on me. They're not easing up on me. And then he says, my eye gazes on their provocation. If you've got the ESV too, the word gazes, again, is a bad translation. ESV has it as, my eye dwells on their provocation. My eye dwells on it. And what Job's saying is that as his friends and people go by and they're calling him names and they're saying that he's a sinner, he can't get his mind off of this. This is eating him up. And it's eating him up so much that it's driving him to the point of death. And I think that's a very important point to make here. The mockers are always upon me, he says. I can't stop thinking about it. They're leveling these false charges against me. And if you've ever been falsely accused of something, you get this, right? It doesn't let up. It's always there. And it is a reputation being robbed from you, right? It's a violation of the commandment, do not steal, right? When we rob somebody's reputation from them. And this is what's happening to Job, right? And imagine this in Job's situation where you're a guy whom God has said, there's nobody on this earth like Job, you know, who's righteous and turns from evil and fears God. And he knows his innocence, and yet now everyone who knows Job is saying, this guy is such a terrible sinner. Look at what God is doing to him. And it's that provocation that he's saying is draining his life out of him. They are conspiring against Job. They are surrounding him with hostility, and this is slowly but surely killing him. As I was thinking about this chapter a couple weeks ago, I was also reading a little bit on Charles Spurgeon and the whole downgrade controversy that he went through. And what that was is in 1887, Spurgeon's the most popular preacher in the world. Everybody loved Spurgeon for the most part. You know, there he had detractors and he took a lot of heat. But up until 1887, he was fairly well received, and he had the backing of what was called the Baptist Union, which was like you could compare it to like the Southern Baptist Church, right? Just an enormous group of churches in England who supported Spurgeon and his work, and he was clearly the biggest church in the world to that point. He had a magazine that he would send out called The Sword and the Trowel. And he published an article in that magazine called The Downgrade. And Spurgeon didn't write the article. It was published anonymously, but his friend Robert Schindler was the one who actually wrote the article, and it was published by him. And what it was asserting is that within the Baptist Union, there were men who were denying cardinal doctrines of the faith, which there was. There was guys in the Baptist Union who were denying the inerrancy of Scripture, the inspiration of Scripture. They were denying substitutionary atonement and even denying that hell was a real place. They were moving towards universalism. And so he publishes this article. And this results in an enormous controversy in Spurgeon's life, the biggest one ever. The result of which, Spurgeon actually gets kicked out of the Baptist Union. He applied for withdrawal. They voted to approve the withdrawal, but the idea of getting kicked out was that they then voted to censor him. Like, none of his materials and sermons could ever get published in the Baptist Union churches. And at the conclusion of his presidential address at his pastor's college, he brings this up and he says, "For my part, I am quite willing to be eaten of dogs for the next 50 years, but the more distant future shall vindicate me." And he was right. The more distant future vindicated Charles Spurgeon, right, enormously. But the toll of that controversy led to Spurgeon's early death in 1892. Like, he made it 5 years after that controversy. And so 5 years after that article appeared, he dies at the age of 57. Completely depressed, completely his body ruined, his kidneys are shutting down. Like, he went from a fairly healthy guy to just to death in a matter of 5 years. And that's what I was thinking about as I considered this chapter. Here's Job, right? Job's the greatest man in the East, way greater than Charles Spurgeon. People are coming to Job for wisdom and advice and questions. And now Job's in this place. He's surrounded by mockers. He's surrounded by people who are calling him a wicked sinner, who are censoring him, who are trying to close his mouth. Even his friends have turned against him. It's interesting, Charles Spurgeon's brother James voted to censor his own brother. Out of the vote, it was like 1,000-5 to censor Spurgeon in the Baptist Union. And so with no one to turn to, you know, Job in the same sort of situation, Job turns to God. Notice this in verses 3 through 5. Now he's praying. "Lay down now a pledge for me with yourself. Who is there that will be my guarantor? For you have kept their heart from understanding, therefore you will not exalt them. He who informs against friends for a share of the spoil, the eyes of his children will also languish. Quite a bit there. First thing, in verse 3, Job is praying that God would make a pledge with him. God, give me a guarantee of well-being. Right? Calvin paraphrases it like this: Lord, since the proud cruelly rush upon me to destroy me, interpose thyself between us as if thou wert my surety. That's what Job wants. Now remember, Job doesn't have the Bible. He doesn't have the promises we have. You know, he doesn't have God causes all things to work together for good. He doesn't have any of that. The degree of revelation that he did have, we don't know. But he's here crying out for God, make a guarantee. Tell me that everything's going to be okay. Right? Even us, with the full revelation of Scripture, we're still doing that, aren't we? God, in the midst of our trials, God, please, like, tell me it's going to be all right. Give me some guarantee that this thing's going to go okay for me. And then in verse 4, he says, you have kept their heart from understanding, therefore you will not exalt them. Job believes, Job's convinced of his innocence, and he's convinced that God is just, and that God will not ultimately allow men to triumph over him, because that would be unjust. Even though God has kept them from understanding, precisely because of that, Job is praying, don't exalt them. Don't let them sit in that exalted position forever, like thinking that they're right and Job's wrong the whole time. And you gotta think about it in the sense of the cross. You know, there's Jesus who gets betrayed and he gets beaten and scourged and hung on the tree, and there he dies. Right? And as Jesus is there, remember they're all mocking him. If you say you're the Son of God, why don't you call on God to bring yourself down? And Jesus does nothing. Lord, I give you my spirit. He gives up his spirit and he dies. And then when Jesus dies, all these things start happening, right? The veil's torn in two, the earth quakes. And remember, there's this centurion who's like, oh, truly this was the Son of God. And I think this is kind of the idea that Job's presenting. In the same sense, God did not allow those people that day to walk away from that situation with Jesus saying, we did the right thing. Right? They were stuck in their sin, we get that. But God made it very clear in the vindication of Christ. And this is what Job's looking for. He doesn't want these unrighteous men to be exalted in their ignorance. And then he quotes a proverb here. So verse 5 is a proverb, probably taken from some other writings. He who informs against friends for a share of the spoil, the eyes of his children also will languish. And what he's doing is he's utilizing that proverb as a warning to his friends. Job is certain that God's going to judge those who were wrong about him. He's certain that God will judge those who are disloyal, those who, like his friends sitting here, turned against Job and began to falsely accuse him of things and did not comfort him and were not there for him. It's a wisdom proverb that describes retribution for disloyalty. That's something that I think we don't put a high standard on in our society anymore. It's kind of every man for himself in our world, and that's sort of ingrained into us. In fact, loyalty is something that, it's almost looked upon as like a bad thing. Like you can be overly loyal to people. And it really is, it's a character quality that is a virtue to be loyal to your friends. And the Bible speaks about it quite a bit in the Proverbs, in fact. And so the verse 5 is really a warning to those who would go around their friends' back for some sake of gain and speak poorly of them in order to help themselves. It's demonstrating the importance of being a loyal and faithful friend to those whom you call your friend. And again, you think about this I'm thinking about it. Now you'll think about it when I tell you, but in the realm of Spurgeon in his day, in this downgrade controversy, as Spurgeon was the most popular preacher in the world. You know, he had all these friends who wanted him to, you know, come and speak at their church, and you know, hopefully they would get invited into his pulpit, and there was all that kind of, you know, he's like the big celebrity that everybody wants to get close to. I mean, it's really interesting. He was the most popular preacher in the world, without a doubt. His sermons, he'd preach them Sunday. I have a copy in my office. You can go look at this, where you'd have a guy who wrote down the sermon word for word. Spurgeon would take it, and then he would edit it that night so that it would go to the papers that night, and they would print a million copies of his sermon, and they would sell it. It was called the penny preacher because they'd sell him for a penny. And he'd sell a million copies of that sermon every single Monday morning. And so here he is, you know, a Job in a lot of ways before his suffering. And like I said, that council votes to censor him 1,000 to 5. You know, in 1 year. And his brother James turns against him. In fact, they adopt this statement called the Compromise Doctrinal Statement that Spurgeon opposed fiercely, because its wording would just let all kinds of bad doctrine into the church. And again, the distant future vindicated Spurgeon, but it wasn't without a cost. You know, he writes a lot about the disloyalty of his friends and his own brother that led to his poor health and ultimately his early death. But you see that and you go, yeah, the legacies of those guys, like who even knows about James Spurgeon? The only reason people know about his brother James is because he voted against his brother Charles. Now, he's a Judas Iscariot in so many ways. They were swept into the dustbin of history. And yet, the guy, Charles Spurgeon, was vindicated by history. And this is what Job's seeking, right? Job is this picture of that. He wants God to bring justice. He wants God to bring truth to light. And he wants God to demonstrate to his friends that God is with him. And even if this trial claims Job's life, in the end, he wants to be publicly vindicated. And I think we can all sympathize with that in our own lives. Now that brings us to what I'm going to call the second point, is that vindication seems so far away and distant for Job that he can't even take hope in it. So you notice verses 6 through 10. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll just start at verse 6. But he has made me a byword of the people, and I am one at whom men spit. Now, a couple of things. First of all, you notice that Job is complaining now that God has done these things to him, but he has made me a byword of the people. And the he here is referencing God. God has made me into, you could translate that as a mocking verse. Someone who serves as a negative example. In fact, I just use it. You want to call someone a betrayer? What do you call him? Judas Iscariot, right? Or you call him Benedict Arnold, the general in the American army who during the Revolutionary War betrayed and shifted over to the British in like 1780 or something. You know, Benedict Arnold is a byword among the people. Job had become a byword in his time, right? One at whom men mock and accuse. And it's in the negative sense because Job's not a byword in our day. In fact, in our day, Job is this shining example of, right, the patience of Job. It's actually the endurance of Job. I'm sure there's a difference there, but we won't get into that. It's held in high esteem. And so history vindicates Job, but at this point in his trial, at this point in his suffering, that vindication is far away. All he knows is that now he's a byword among everyone. Verse 7, my eye has also grown dim because of grief, and all my members are as a shadow. My life is fading away. My body is wasting away. It's devolving. This is really, it's kind of interesting. Me and Evelyn were at the governor's house here in town having a little dinner thing with him and his some of his employees on Monday. And he was taking me through the house and showing me his art collection. And he's really into these sculptures that this Spanish guy does, who I can't remember his name. And like he had one of Adam and Eve and one of like an American soldier on something. But then he had this one with Job. And he's like, I got to show you this one with Job. And it's upstairs in his bathroom. And so he takes me up there. And he's telling me it's about how Job's suffering. And I walk in there expecting like a portrayal of Job and his suffering. But so all these sculptures are naked people. You know, I don't know what it is with artists. Like they're into that. And so here's this picture of Job. He's kind of like laying on the ground, kind of writhing. But he looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger in the 1980s. You know, like veiny muscles and just like, you don't know if he's writhing in pain or if he's flexing for the camera, you know. And I made it just a quick quip, and I probably shouldn't have said it. And I was like, he looks pretty healthy for Job. And he says, yeah, the artist, whatever his name was, he couldn't bring himself to put the boils and the scabs and all of that on him. And I said, well, I don't know if that's an accurate depiction of Job. And I'm you know, arguing with the governor of money. I'm just a jerk. But the depiction was wrong, right? Job is wasting away, right? He's near death in this agony. He's a shadow of his former self. And this verse is talking, he's shriveled and he's fading and he's nearing death. And you would come upon him and you wouldn't go, wow, I mean, you're going through a lot, but you're looking good. He looks terrible. And Gerald Wilson comments on this. He says, the slow slide into oblivion is a response to the ongoing anguish of his oppressing circumstances rather than just grief. Right? Job's not just sad, which was what this author depicted, like he's got a little tear coming out of his eye in the sculpture and stuff, and he's looking sad. But I think we have to remember that this is like when we picture Christ being torn to bits in his crucifixion, and just a complete, like, disgusting image of humanity on the cross. This is what Job looks like, right? He's in the ash heap in the dump outside the city, and his body's wrecked. So verse 8, he goes on, the upright will be appalled at this, and the innocent will stir up himself against the godless. Nevertheless, the righteous will hold his way, and he who has clean hands will grow stronger and stronger. But come again, all of you now, for I did not find a wise man among you. Okay, this is a tough one, okay? Because as you read that, it's hard to catch that this is actually sarcasm, okay? This is like mocking ridicule at the friends, okay? So he says, my eye has grown dim because of grief. All my members are as a shadow. The upright will be appalled at this. The innocent will stir himself up against the godless. And what he's doing is he's talking to his friends, because this is what his friends have done to him. His friends have seen him in this state, and their worldview, that is the doctrine of retribution, that if you do bad, you get bad. You do good, you get good. Therefore, we have to assume that Job has done bad. This is their response. The upright, in quotations, you could say, they're appalled at this image. Right, they see the broken man laying there, and they think, "Oh, what a disgusting human being!" Clearly, he has violated God's commands. He's a sinner, and he's one at whom men will scorn. And he says, "The innocent will stir up himself against the godless." Right, and the godless would be Job, in the assumption here. His friends are saying, "We're innocent. Our lives are good. We're not suffering." And so we see you in this state, and this is an indication that you're a godless man. They don't know what sin Job has committed to be worthy of this, But through his trials, they see him as a sinner who's deserving of this, and thus they lack compassion for Job. They're worried that if this could happen to Job, this could happen to any one of us, right? And so they stir themselves up against him. They're the self-proclaimed innocent who are now mocking the one they think is ungodly. And again, it's reminiscent of the people standing at the foot of the cross saying, oh man, if you were right and you were the Son of God, you could take yourself down from the cross right now. And you could prove us all wrong. But because you can't, now we're vindicated. Now we know that we were right in crucifying the Son of God. And it's because, again, this is what happens when you do not have the category of innocent suffering. If you do not have the category of innocent suffering, when you see someone suffering, you will automatically assume that it's because of their sin and because God is punishing them, and that you need to be appalled at that person as a result. You need to stand against them. And so it's a description of Job's oppressors, who are entirely devoted to that worldview, and no argument's going to change their mind. In fact, Job's suffering is just sitting here serving as a further vindication that they're right, right? Because Job keeps on suffering. So in verse 9, he keeps going with this line of thought, this sarcasm. Nevertheless, the righteous will hold to his way, and he who has clean hands will go stronger and stronger. So again, that's the clue that it's sarcasm, right? Because this is what they've been telling him. If you had clean hands and you were really upright, you wouldn't be getting weaker and weaker. You would be getting stronger and stronger. So I know it's hard to catch that sarcasm, especially in the English text. And giving a Hebrew lesson, I would just confuse you because I'm not that good at Hebrew. But it is a sarcastic attack against Job's friends. And you see this again in verse 10. Job actually moves to taunting his friends. This is one of the things I like about the Bible. You know, I don't know if you ever watch like boxing or what's the other gig now? They just beat each other up. They don't have any. The UFC. And the fighters will like get in there and get cocky and put their head out there and they'll swing and miss. This is what Job's doing, right, in verse 10. But come again, all of you now, for I do not find a wise man among you. What he's saying is, verses 8 and 9, you guys aren't any of those people. None of you are wise. And so Job's actually taunting them, I know I'm right. My argument has won, and I dare you to come and bring an argument against me. So he goes back to what he's doing is he's ridiculing them for their inconsistencies now. But with this in mind, Job is also resigned to the idea that he may never be vindicated in this world. It may never happen for him. And so verses 11 through 16 are the results of his hope just kind of fading away in that realm. He says in verse 11, my days are past, my plans are torn apart, even the wishes of my heart. So this is his pessimistic outlook. And his point is, the days are done for me. There's no time left for me to be vindicated now. There's no way that vindication can be in sight when my life is just slipping away this quickly. All of my plans are torn apart. And what he's talking about is all of his plans. His plans for his family. Surely he had plans for all of his wealth. Everything he had in life has been stripped away from him. He's got no more plans. In a sense, he's saying, I've got nothing to live for. Even the desires of my heart are gone. I don't have any desires left. And his friends, in the midst of this, have sat there and chided him by saying, Job, you can just turn all of this around if you'll simply just confess your sin. I mean, imagine just the brutality of hearing that from your supposed comforters. You just do this, Job, you can have it all back. That's what verse 12 is about. They make night into day, saying the light is near, in the presence of darkness. One of the things I said when we went into this book was Job is a lot about learning how not to be a sorry comforter. And we have to recognize how often we have the tendency to combat others' pain and suffering in their life with these really stupid, naive declarations that it's all going to work out in the end. Right? It's all going to work out in the end. People will be going through a terrible trial, and we just revert to, now remember, God's going to cause it all to work together for good. Everybody who's a Christian knows that. But when you're sitting in the darkness, it's not helpful for someone to say, hey, the light's coming. I know you can't see it, but it's coming. Don't worry. One day it's going to show up. God's going to cause all things to work together for good. And that's true. He does. But that doesn't mean you will experience it in this life. Right? Charles Spurgeon dies as a byword. He never got his vindication. You know, he got it in the sense in heaven he's vindicated, you know. But you can go through major trials in life, major darkness, and never come out of it in this world. And so we have to be really careful about the way that we comfort others when they're in those times of darkness. One writer said, our cheerful words of faith can be like rubbing salt in the wounds or slapping the face of one who is crying. Our words at such time may have more to do with shoring up our faith than with showing solidarity with our suffering friend. Says this may be our way of dealing with the attack on our carefully ordered world that their devastation represents. He says, Job's caustic reply offers us wisdom, that those in deep pain and sorrow often need our love and compassion, our strong arms and anguished silence, our admission of the mystery of suffering and pain, and our acknowledgement that others have traveled this road before. When people are going through, you know, a terrible loss, you know, Tom and Wanda are an example. You know, Mike said to me, I just don't, you know, he gave him a ride to the hospital. What do you say? You say nothing. There is nothing to say in that situation. They're in the darkness. And you can sit there and shout about light all you want. And all that is rubbing salt in a wound. You say, I don't know. Don't know why this is happening. I don't have a clue. And in anguished silence, you simply bear with them. When you try to fix it, man, it's the worst thing you can do. It's the worst thing you can do. And some people, you know, will turn that against you later. They'll say, well, you didn't minister to me in my sorrow. Is there any way to minister to someone in that sorrow? It's as baffling to me as it is to them, you know. And we make things worse when we move into the trite kind of Hallmark card approach. If I just remind you of, you know, Romans 8 for the 10 millionth time in your life, suddenly you're going to feel better. Sometimes you just need to cry with people. Just cry with them and leave it there. And this is what Job's responding to. You know, this unrealistic idea that it's all going to work out in the end for you. In verses 13 and 14, he says, if I look for Sheol as my home, I make my bed in the darkness. And what he's saying there is, I'm looking for Sheol as my hope, my home, my resting place. I'm making my bed in the darkness as my hope. Right? If I call to the pit, you are my father, to the worm, my mother and my sister. And then he says, where now is my hope? Who regards my hope? Will it go down with me to Sheol? Shall we together go down into the dust? What is my hope at this point when I can see no hope and death is upon me? The only foreseeable hope for Job was death. And what kind of a hope is that in life? It's not much of a hope. You know, and I'm getting into some really deep theology here when I begin talking about Sheol and what all that's about. You know, that wasn't going into the presence of God. That was the place of the dead with the two compartments, one of comfort and one of anguish. But you notice again how appropriate this is to the life and death of Jesus Christ. Christ was oppressed by his enemies. Christ was put on the cross. He was put to death. And his final vindication still waits. Right? He's vindicated in heaven. He's vindicated in front of the saints. He's vindicated in front of the spirits of all the dead. But there's still a whole world with billions of people in it who deny Jesus as Lord. And his final vindication comes when he returns, and every knee shall bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Job will be vindicated before he dies. Right? We're going to see that as we get to the end of the book here. But for Jesus and for many of the saints, our vindication is probably going to wait until Jesus' return. And that's a tough pill to swallow in this life. Right, to know that you could die with the whole world thinking that you're a lost, terrible sinner because you endured suffering in life. Right, we may be willing, as Spurgeon said, to be eaten by dogs for the next 50 years, knowing the distant future will vindicate us. But that doesn't mean it's not going to take its toll. It's not going to extract something from us. So although Job's going to be vindicated soon in the story, this is his mindset, right? Death is near to him. Public vindication can't happen because he's going to die in his own mind before it can happen. And the result is a fading hope. For him, the grave is saying to him, all hope abandon ye who enter here. Right? There's no hope of vindication for you. Whereas we know that death brings us into the presence of God. And as we saw in the book of Revelation, remember, the saints have rest there, but what are they doing in that altar? Crying out for vindication. Lord, when are you going to exact vengeance on our enemies? And we have to wait for God's justice. And so again, what we're finding here is a very practical approach to just the trials of life. You're going to get falsely accused of things. You're going to have a toll taken on you in your life because of those things. And you may never see vindication in this life, but that's okay because Jesus hasn't yet seen full vindication.